This conference is now being recorded.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, everybody. We have on the call Mikey O'Connor, James Bladel, Greg Aaron, Faisal Shaw, Barry Cobb, and Robert Hutchinson. And for staff, we have Marika Koenig, Margie Milam, and Glenn de Saint-Jury. Have I left off anybody? Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Glenn. And welcome to this edition of Registration Abuse Policy Working Group. I'm your host, Greg Aaron. We have a small group today, but thank you for joining us. And we hope to get through a lot of material today. We're going to check in with our cyber squatting and uniformity of contracts groups, and then, if at all possible, we're going to try to rip through the remaining list of topics that people had raised and see if any of those require further work or if they can be dispensed with. So why don't we begin with, why don't we begin with Barry and his crew, because you just sent out a document on Friday. So would you like to take over, Barry?
Sure thing. This is Barry Cobb. Thank you, Greg. Basically, the Uniformity of Contracts team met together last week. We've basically kind of just tried to finalize what their recommendations would be coming out of our little sub-team. And we went through a first draft of our recommendations report, and since then a kind of a second or maybe third draft has been submitted. For anybody that's interested, go out to the Uniformity of Contracts wiki. All the activity and documents are posted out there, specifically the latest one, which is the draft B3 of our recommendations report. I'll just quickly run through the report and just touch on the highlights, and then everybody else can go into the details. We'll mostly just hone in on the recommendations for the purposes of this call, and then perhaps the next meeting, when we have a bigger group, we can talk about any issues or any problems that people may have with the report. And then just one slight caveat, this latest draft, the UFC team hasn't really had a chance to completely review it. So there might be a couple of small recommendations. That's why I'm still keeping it as a draft. But I don't suspect that it'll change dramatically between now and there. So that's why we went ahead and posted it up onto the wiki. Excuse me. So with that in mind, I'll brush through page by page and touch on the important stuff. And if anybody has a question, just interrupt me. And then we'll talk about it and move on to the next. So starting on page one, we got it on the Adobe Connect as well. Page one, title page, page two, standard template, issues, background, nothing new there. We know the issues. The background's basically just kind of a retracement of what the team went through. The next little section, or it's still within the background section, which is hopefully somewhat new, I felt it was important to try to put a picture to the scope of what we were dealing with, and the result of that is what you'll see on page four, which is the agreement relationship diagram. I won't jump into details, but people kind of study this, and if they've got any changes or recommendations to enhance this chart, go for it. But basically, the idea here was to represent who all of the associated parties are relative to agreements or registration agreements, et cetera, and the contracts. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, there's some noise on the line, but okay. Are you on a cell phone?
I am, but I'm stationary, so it shouldn't be. It's never been a problem. There it goes.
That's a little better. By the way, Rod Rasmussen has joined.
Yeah, I think it might be my phone. There's just a little bit of noise. I'm going to get that fixed.
Rob, you are
the culprit. That sounds like you, Rod. Okay, yeah, thanks for muting. Okay, go ahead, Barry.
Okay, anyway, we tried to list the parties that were within scope and then the agreements or contracts that bound those parties. So, you know, basically starting at the top, we've got the ICANN board is really kind of what that's supposed to represent. Then you've got registries, registrars, the registrant, and then we also threw in indication for resellers and hosting providers and Internet users. And then the takeaway here is the four primary agreements that are in scope in terms of understanding dispersion or lack of uniformity in contracts was the registry agreement, the RAA, the RRA, and what I dubbed as little a, which is the registration agreement, as well as, although we didn't really get into the scope of trying to determine dispersion, then we've also got the little RR, little a agreement, which is the registrar reseller agreement. So anyway, the takeaway here is just to provide a visual as to what we were dealing with, and hopefully there's some value there. On page 5 is basically just a summary table of our dispersion findings. What I tried to do here was by agreement, list out kind of a summary result of what we found. So pretty much, I think, as everybody can guess on the phone, is, you know, that while there is some uniformity out there, there's really not any uniformity at all within scope agreements and across the board. So it's surprisingly kind of a free-for-all, if you will. Most of the uniformity that you find is specifically with like the RAA or the RRA, which are derived from templates. But even there's still some variation or dispersion with those. So anyway, the takeaway here is within our four in-scope agreements, the RA, RRA, RAA, and little r, little a, we did find dispersion. Those top four have a dedicated appendix section that dives into the details, and we'll cover those in a little bit. The last subsection for the background is basically the team's conclusions and guiding principles. And I won't go through all the details here, but in general, we basically had three guiding principles. The first is that we do recognize there is dispersion out there or lack of uniformity among contracts or agreements. The team feels that some sort of uniformity is important, and it will help promote equal competition. The second kind of guiding principle is that in reference to trying to create some uniformity, a minimal baseline of abuse provisions should be created. And then thirdly, kind of to be continued, we do realize that this is a pre-PDP. I personally suspect that this will definitely evolve into a formal PDP, but nonetheless, the team came up with the notion that, you know, we're really just kind of scratching the surface, that a more formal PDP will be required to move this stuff forward. And in the meantime, where possible, market participants should try to, you know, kind of go alone or take it on their own to start addressing abuse up until the formal PDP, et cetera, can catch up to everybody. So those are kind of the three guiding principles for the team. Those will flesh out more into the recommendations, which I believe is on the next page. Okay, so any questions up to this point before I get into recommendations? Okay.
Barry, this is Greg. I had a question.
Sure.
You had said something about the market and policies allowing parties to compete more evenly. Is that in the document?
Yes, it's under the dispersion consistency on page 5, 6. Basically, it's just the statement is that, you know, it's our belief that increased uniformity is important for the marketplace, and it does help promote equal competition.
I'll find it. Thank you.
Yep. Okay, so recommendations. Basically, the team right now came up with four recommendations. Like I said, I don't think we've all had a chance to completely digest these, so they are up for some slight modifications after the Mike and Mikey and James kind of review this and we update it. First recommendation basically is to create an abuse provision baseline, and in the living in the world of acronyms, we're calling it an APB. So basically, the recommendation here is that we believe that a formal PDP should be formed, a greater PDP, not a, I don't know that a individual PDP for just about uniformity of contracts is necessary, but like I mentioned, I've got a feeling that a larger registration abuse PDP will be formed someday, and the intent would be to piggyback off of that. And what we try to do is kind of just put some boundaries about what that PDP should look like. So basically the takeaway here is that there's some sort of baseline of abuse provisions that's created that should be loaded into the varying agreements that we have across the market participants. And I was very... I don't know if careful is the word or not, but between recommendation one and recommendation two, they're really almost the same, but I split it apart versus substance in recommendation one and scope in recommendation two. And the reason for that is I didn't want recommendation two to necessarily, if there was any disagreement in recommendation two about the scope deployment, I didn't want that to affect the content of the agreement. So I'll kind of boil this down into layman's terms between recommendation one and then really recommendation two. Recommendation one is strictly about what content or what that minimum baseline should look like for agreements. Recommendation two gets into the scope deployment. Should it only go to the registration agreement, or should it cover all agreements? And that's something that needs to be flushed out. And really, and I guess kind of the takeaway about recommendation two is that the scope deployment could affect what that minimum baseline means. And what that translates to is a minimum baseline may or may not accommodate a registration agreement, or it may or may not accommodate an RAA or the other types of agreements. So basically I'm kind of leaving the door open that the APB may need to be modified to cover the varying agreements, but at this point we just don't really know. Questions about recommendation one or two, did that make sense?
I have a question. It's Greg. When you're talking about abuses, what kinds of abuses are we talking about? Is this really about malicious uses of domain names or something else?
No, that's a good question. I guess I'm going to backdoor my way into answering your question. I think from our last call, when I had talked about our status of where we were with the UFC team, I had led on to the notion that I kind of had this revelation from some of the presentations in ICANN. Bottom line, these first two recommendations and also in Appendix 5, we kind of have an example of what an APB might look like. I'll be perfectly honest here. You know, I'm stealing this from the PIR presentation, basically. That presentation, the way that it was structured, again, to me, perfectly aligns to with what this working group is all about. And so the recommendations are really kind of structured around what is already out there in use today. So
let me ask you about what specifically about the PIR recommendation. Are you saying the abuse policy they have, or what allowed them to have the abuse policy?
The abuse policy in of itself. So if you look at that abuse policy, it has a standard definition of abuse, and I think that they've even took it to the next level of defining varying types of abuse under that definition. And then the second critical part to that is the indemnification that allows them to do the rapid takedown and those kinds of things.
Well, Well, I think there's also another issue, which is what allowed them to do that in the first place, which is they have some language in their ICANN contract that says that they can set certain policies for the registrars or certain policies within their TLD. And that's what Mike Rodenbaugh was pointing out when he actually asked the council to come up with our working group, because his thing was that the .com.net contract doesn't have the same language that, for example, some of these other TLDs have. So I think one of the things we'll have to look at is, are we talking about making people have specific things that say you can't do phishing, you can't do malware, et cetera, or are you, do we also need to take this up a level and say, do all registries or registrars have the ability to do these things? I think that's something we're going to have to look at.
This is Mikey. I'm going to jump in here. I agree with that. I think that probably the reason you don't see it here is because we didn't view that particular issue as really part of the scope of what we were on. And so we just didn't. I don't think we disagree with that idea. I just don't think we took it up.
I think it's absolutely within scope, because that's why this group is in existence.
Oh, yeah, in terms of the larger working group and in terms of...
Yeah, the larger group. Yeah, now the indemnification is something very different. I need to... I probably need to address it now just because it's a definitional thing. No one... Well, the indemnification is a funny thing. There's actually... We're going to have to get into that a little bit. We have two issues. One is if, say, a registrar registry takes down a domain name, are they indemnified by the registrant, for example? That's one issue. If a registry takes down a domain name, are they indemnified by the registrar? That's another thing. The big issue, I think, one of the big issues is if you force... If ICANN forces people to have abuse policies and enforce them, can ICANN indemnify them? This is actually a question we've been asked to look at because of the FastFlux question that was forwarded to us by the council, which is if we have a PDP, and one of the questions is going to be if there's a PDP that you make people have policies and do stuff as a result, can ICANN indemnify them? So we've got to work that into the discussion somehow. Maybe we don't solve it in this group, but it's one of the things that we're obligated to ask.
Well, and Greg, and this is James, and the corollary to that is if the answer is no, that ICANN cannot offer any protection to registrars for carrying out prescribed policies, then it really gets to the heart of whether or not ICANN should even be creating policy in this area.
I would agree with that. This is Barry. The question I have is, you know, regardless of how to me it was blatantly aware of the successes that PIR had from their presentation. I certainly don't know the details. I don't know what practices they did behind the scenes, but it was more than obvious. And so I guess I'm kind of struggling working in the policy-making world, but, I'm not sure how PIR even can really say, are they truly indemnified with what their actions, but my take on it is they didn't necessarily seem to care. They see the abuses as a big enough problem that they were going to move forward with it and roll with the punches as it happened. And I'm not saying that's what we should be recommending here, but they just went ahead and did it. And so that's kind of like the baseline of why we put these recommendations together, is pretty much modeling off of what exists out there.
I'll say something then, and then we'll move to James. The PIR policy is basically word for word the policy that I wrote for .info, and I helped PIR with their operation, so I'm intimately familiar with what they do. What they have in their contract is something that a lot of registries have, and it says basically the registry operator has the right to set some policies within its TLD. So what we did, and then later what PIR did, was we said we want an anti-abuse policy. And it says, you know, we don't want to see the following things happening in the TLD. Now, what it does not say, and this is really important, is it does not force a registrar to do anything. We cannot do it. One reason is the registrars did not want to allow us to have the ability to force them to take down domain names, because that involved liability on their part. Fair enough. Now, what both Phileas and PIR did was we said we are willing to, we're going to work with our registrars. On occasion, we will take the initiative to suspend domain names. We are doing that on our own risk. And that's the crux, one of the cruxes of the issue, I think, which is these companies have decided they're going to assume that risk, and they're going to figure out how to manage it themselves, and they'll decide when to suspend domain names or not. So one of the questions is, do you want to give companies the ability to do that, make their own choices about when to do that, or are we going to recommend that ICANN force people to take those kinds of actions? And that gets back to what James said, which is, can ICANN even do that? And I think it also depends on what kind of abuses you're talking about. Malicious uses of domain names is the subject we're going to have a conversation about, you know, is this kind of thing something that ICANN can mandate or not? That's an interesting question we have to get to. So anyway, let me go on to James.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Just real quickly, I also wanted to chime in and without discounting any of the impact of the efforts that INFO and PIR have undertaken at the registry level, I just wanted to point out that as a registrar, GoDaddy has a very extensive, active, and we've invested quite a bit in our abuse department. We have numerous talented people and tools, and so we feel, at least I feel, that that registry level intervention should be rare, or it should apply to registrars probably that don't take the initiative on security issues. I just wanted to put this out here as, we're not looking at this where a registrar and a registry disagree on how to pursue a certain situation, and so the registry issues some sort of an override or veto at a higher level. It's much more of a, I see that policy as kind of filling in the gaps for the registrars who don't take the initiatives on their own.
I see Rod's hand, and then Mikey.
Okay. I think you've gotten right to the crux of kind of the whole shooting match here to some extent. A couple of points is that one on requirements versus providing cover, as it were. I think that's an important distinction, and it can be carried through all the way to the level of ICANN. ICANN can indemnify people, but who's going to indemnify ICANN? And then you're starting to get into the realm of national governments, but ICANN's an international organization, so I'm not sure who they go to. It all gets back down to who's going to take on the liability for taking action. I think another the counterpoint to that, which I think is also important, is who takes on the liability for inaction. So if you create policy or contracts around saying it's okay to do something, and then you don't do it, and let's say it's a registrar saying to their resellers, you need to look at this and take care of this problem, or the registry to the registrar, et cetera, that comes along with the same territories, then who do you go to for inaction, as much as for taking positive action and making a mistake, who do you go to for inaction and that being a mistake? So I think that's an area that needs to be fleshed out as part of this as well if we're going to be making any recommendations around this topic area of saying we need to provide kind of the indemnity or the requirements for at various levels. Anyways, that's my bit. Sorry, it's a little convoluted.
Mikey?
I think I'm agreeing with everybody that we're sort of at the nub of the issue, and I am thinking that we might be well served with some sort of diagram of this that sort of shows the risk chain, both the positive and the negative risk, the way that Rob just described it. One of the voices that's not on this call, but the ghost of Wendy Seltzer is speaking in my ear, and of course, there is the issue of, and I think Rod's getting at that when you talk about who's liable for a mistake. I think that if we can puzzle this last 5 minutes of conversation out well and address both sides of the risk chain, that we will have created something pretty important in the history of ICANN. And so I would agree that this is probably one of the most important parts of our conversation. And I do want to sort of lay down some foam under the uniformity of contracts team. We would certainly cheerfully probably take this on, but we certainly weren't discussing this much. We were on a much narrower mission when we did this report.
But what's interesting, it ties back into the big questions of you can have contracts that are uniform, but what do they actually say? That's the question, I think.
Yeah.
Uniformity for the sake of uniformity actually isn't probably interesting or useful unless we have some idea of what we're shooting for.
Well,
what's the purpose?
This is Mikey again. I wouldn't go quite that far because, the points that we're making in this report is that absolute uniformity across all contracts is probably infeasible, but some sort of baseline standard is not only feasible but also quite useful, and that's what then opened the door into this broader discussion. So, I wouldn't say that it's totally without interest, but I think that there's some middle ground there.
Okay. All right. Barry, see your hand raised?
Yeah. So, I guess I agree with everything that Mikey just said as well. I think that this also touches on, the boundary between what is policy versus execution, which is really kind of the last recommendation, and I'll get into that in just a second. But and this is just Barry speaking on his behalf, nobody else or the team or anything. But personally, to me, and I mentioned this on our last UFC call, is, if we could flip the light switch on tomorrow this minimum baseline as purely an example that's down in Appendix 5, I don't see any harm at all of every or of the four main contracts in scope, why they all shouldn't have that kind of language and or a sub-policy that was created similar to PIR.info, but some existence of this minimum baseline across all contracts. It's very general. It's very high level, as you know, Greg. But, you know, it gives a definition, and it gives a statement about indemnification. And then the other half of all of that, so if we flip the light switch on and it's all in the contracts, then it's all about the execution behind it. And I'm not necessarily sure that if that language was in every contract tomorrow, that necessarily everybody would still be executing to that, if that made sense. I guess I'll go ahead and just talk about recommendation four, and this is definitely out of the scope for UOC and anything along those lines, but it really kind of goes back to our third guiding principle is, you know, it's going to be a very long while, and I'm guessing because I'm still new to all of this, but before any kind of PDP goes on or any kind of RCEP process or any formalized changes to agreements in reference to a minimum abuse baseline, it's going to be a while before any of that happens. So the key phrase that I have there is, you know, let's not stop best from allowing us to get better. And, you know, ultimately is whether we make the recommendation about having uniformity or contracts or not is, you know, that last recommendation is all about disseminating the activities of what PIR and .info have done and somehow lighting a fire or motivating the rest of the industry to start doing it on their own. And so that's, again, the separation between policy and execution. So I'll stop there.
Yeah. I think your policy has to come first before any consideration of execution. And, you know, there are entities out there who say that abuse is not their problem because they're just, you know, a neutral provider of services or what have you. The question is, you can have a policy that allows them to do something, but they won't do anything necessarily. That won't make anything better. So, I mean, it would be a step in the right direction to make sure that everyone's empowered to do something if they wish. That's one thing. The other question, though, before us is, what are you going to force people to do?
Right.
So I think they're two related but also separable questions. I think execution comes after policy.
Well, but, yeah, I do totally agree with that. I guess, you know, what is it that motivated PIR and affiliates to move forward and not wait for formal policy. They created their own one way or then another, and then they started executing against it. And any responsible market participant should be doing the same in my mind, personally. I mean, that's just the nature of it. So I'll get off my soapbox. Let me cover recommendation three, and then there's a couple more high-level points, and then I'll turn the floor back over. Recommendation three is also out of scope for UOC, but I felt it was important to list here to bring to the larger working group, and we can talk about it, and then I'll do whatever we need to with in terms of the report. Recommendation three is in terms of all of my analysis that we've done in terms of, dispersion of contracts, et cetera. I've yet to come across a uniform and consistent method in which abuse gets reported. And it seems to be kind of all over the map, unless there's something lurking out there that I haven't found. But in general, the recommendation is that, you know, there needs to be an upfront, uniform way in which any market participant can report a particular abuse, and then somehow the parties involved at the registry, registrar level, and ICANN for that matter, are somehow communicated to. Basically, the general premise here is of the recommendation is that there doesn't seem to be any uniform method that exists out there today. And the question on the table is this something that we should try to move forward with? You know, we have the input of complaints or through the ICANN process. Then we have, I think, what is called the IC3, which is a joint task force between the FBI and some other departments where abuses can be communicated to there. But I haven't seen, or you can go directly to your own registrar if you wanted and try to submit an abuse there. But I haven't seen or heard of or come across anything that streamlines it across the entire chain. And that was the intent of that recommendation. Okay, so a couple of more quick points, and then I'll turn the floor over. Page 11 is a kind of a, it's just basically a page of questions that we still need to answer that the team hasn't gotten to. We've kind of covered most of them one way or another. We just need to flush out just to some of the final answers that could maybe influence any of our other recommendations. But that sheet will come out once we move this into a final version. Lastly is just the appendices. There's five appendices. The first two cover the RA and the RRA, and ICANN staff did a good job of pointing to the dispersion and those agreement categories within the issues report. So instead of pulling it into this report, I just linked to it. The third appendix covers the RAA, and as everybody knows, that's kind of a template, so there really isn't dispersion there, but there is a lack of abuse language in comparison to what maybe an APB might look like. And combined with the fact that, you know, there is an RAA working group, and they have signaled that they recognize that there are some pretty large gaps relative to abuse and malicious conduct, and that's something that they're working on. Appendix 4 is the dispersion research for the actual registration agreements, which we reviewed on this call earlier, and it just has some, hopefully, some other screenshots that help refine or scope into how we came up with what we came up with. And then Appendix 5 is just kind of what an APB example is, all of which you know, are from other sources. The definition of abuse comes out of our working group. The specific listings of abuse were pulled from the .info anti-abuse policy, and then the indemnification again, which I think both .info and .org had in their contracts. So, again, this was just an example and not meant to necessarily influence what any future PDP would create a baseline with. So that's the gist of the report. I do invite everybody to rip it apart, send me comments or questions, and we'll make it better to include into the master report. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Barry. Okay. Does anybody else have any questions for Barry? Okay. So, Barry, my thought is to put this document out for comment to the wider group. We'll eventually have to work through the recommendations and hear everybody's comments, but we might as well start doing that now if anybody has any they'd like to share on the list. Would you be able to post a markup possible version to the list. We've got a PDF right now, but maybe a Word or RTF that people could mark up if, or comment on if they like. What I suggest is people get a chance to comment on it, ask questions, mark it up, and then at some point we'll take a version of that and we'll incorporate it into a Marika's master document that she's eventually going to be putting together, basically cut and paste into her master. Does that sound okay?
Will do, Greg. I'll get the marked up version posted here in a few minutes.
Okay. Okay. Are you going to send Word, do you think?
Yeah, I'll make sure it's an older Word.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, guys, for your work on this. I think it's helped us distill some really interesting questions in this call that we'll need to continue to discuss. It's also extremely helpful to have the meat here on paper. So thank you very much for your hard work and the extra meetings that you sat in on to produce this work. Thanks very much.
Oh, this is Mikey. I just need to reiterate our kudos for Barry. Barry is the reason that this is such a spectacular piece of work.
Okay, we could go over to cyber squatting next. So, who wants to take the lead on that one?
Greg, is there anyone but me from that team on the call?
Unless Faisal.
Hey, okay. I was just looking over the list. Hi, Faisal. I'll go ahead and start it off, and then Faisal, if you want to jump in and take it from there. But essentially, Greg, there's been very little change since our last meeting. We had boiled down some definitional work as well as some recommendations that we had consensus on the working group. What you had asked for at the end of the last meeting was a background of the issue and our work, and what we were able to arrive at, and then to post those items to the wiki, which was a little delinquent in doing, but I did get that done. Marika helped me get that done this weekend. So listed up here, I think you'll recognize that the definitional work and the recommendations down there are repeats from our previous call. What is new, however, is just the introductory sentences are on the background. So three bullet points. First one is that why we targeted cyber squatting, how we defined cyber squatting, and then some of the challenges that were encountered in balancing all of the interests in that.
Okay. Thank you.
So for the most part, it is more of a refresh and a reposting of the material from our last call.
Okay. All right. And then you have, it looks like, three recommendations.
That's correct. Three recommendations. One, and if you'd like, I can go through them now, but we did kind of touch on them last time around. But the first recommendation was that, what this conversation uncovered was that there are a lot of issues, concerns, shortcomings, failings, or perceived problems with the UDRP as a process. And rather than trying to comprehensively enumerate all of those and address them in this sub-working group of this pre-PDP, we decided that a single umbrella recommendation would be that there should be a subsequent PDP to take a look at the UDRP, how it's functioning, what its uses are, is it effective as anti-cyber squatting mechanism as well as something that is used to resolve legitimate claims, disputing but legitimate claims, and what can be done to update, refresh, and improve the UDRP as a process.
I have a question. So the first recommendation reads as follows. If the UDRP requires revision to make it more effective, as an anti-cyber squatting mechanism, it should be revised as part of a subsequent PDP to update the policy. So the recommendation would be to the council to discuss whether the UDRP requires revision?
Recommendation would be, I think, going through the normal process would be first to, you know, kick it off with an issues report, correct?
Mm-hmm.
To understand and to gather information from the community on their perception of the UDRP and its efficacy as both a dispute resolution system as well as an anti-cyber squatting tool or an anti-abuse tool, and then to collect all of the issues that were uncovered and all of the open wounds that we ran into when discussing this issue, and see if we can get those all in a clearinghouse type of a document where they can be examined by the policy, by the council, and determine whether or not and a policy, a PDP should be undertaken and what it should look like.
Yeah, this is Fievel. I also kind of come alongside that. I think that one of the things that, you know, at least what we're seeing and hearing is that the UDRP really isn't an effective tool. So, I mean, assuming that there is a finding that it is not an effective tool anymore, we don't think, at least I don't believe that the fast track, which is more of a procedural mechanism, may be the only thing that needs to be done. And maybe I think we probably need to look more at the content and the actual rules behind the UDRP to see whether we can make it more effective as an anti-cyber squatter mechanism. So maybe there's more work that needs to be done there. And I think what we were trying to do here is say, look, we're not going to make the leap that it needs to be a more effective tool. But there seems to be a lot of chatter that there needs to be some revision to the UDRP. So assuming that, we think you should take a look at the UDRP to see whether or not you can do more than just the fast track. Maybe there should be more effort looking at the actual rules themselves, the policies themselves behind the UDRP to see whether it can be updated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so,
and Faisal, that's very well said. I think, you know, the short answer, Greg, is that it was very, very difficult to tease out cyber squatting issues without it turning into a discussion of all the issues surrounding UDRP.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
We're trying to extract and isolate that subject, and then move on in the absence of UDRP issues.
Right. So, and you mentioned the issues report, which is one of the tools that the council uses to understand the various facets of the issue and decide what they want to do, if anything. Should our recommendation be that an issues report be written?
Okay, so
on UDRP?
My understanding was that the issues report was a requirement, a first test or a first checkpoint of the PDP process, and that in order to better inform the council's decision on whether a PDP should take place, and if so, what its charter should look like, you know, yes, we're recommending that a PDP should be initiated, and the first step in that, I guess, would be an issues report to determine whether that PDP goes forward. And I guess I'm leading that question by saying I think we all understand the answer to be yes, but leaving the door open for the possibility that somewhere along the line it's going to fail to meet the council's test somewhere.
I forget, actually. We would need to look into it. Or maybe Marika, maybe you can answer this, and Margie. Can you have an issues report first and then a PDP starts, or can you only get an issues report after the council's decided to have a PDP?
This is Marika. There's a bit of confusion over the terminology. Like, the initiation of the PDP happens after the issues report. But sometimes the request of the issues report is, you know, you can consider it part of the overall process of a policy development process. But actual decision on an initiation happens after the issues report is delivered, and what triggers the issues report is just a request for an issues report by one of the constituencies or stakeholder groups, and that gets then a positive vote. That's the only thing that's required for an issues report. It doesn't require the formal initiation of a PDP, although if you look at the overall structure, it's a necessary step in, further down the road, the formal initiation of the PDP.
Okay. And Greg, if I'm jumping ahead to step two by saying PDP, then let's just change it to calling for an issues report.
Well, that would allow people to get that report out, which would list all these issues that have been kind of burbling up in the community.
And just as an aside thought, requesting an issues report on such a narrowly defined topic such as UDRP reform could probably, and I don't want to jump too far ahead here, but could possibly even come in parallel with the work of the RAP.
Okay. All right. I'm looking at the recommendations. Maybe we should think about the wording of those. If our group wants to recommend that there be an issues report to get at specific things. I mean, what we're saying is there are some questions about UDRP's current effectiveness as an anti-cyber squatting mechanism. It also ties into various discussions of rights protection mechanisms, which is your second recommendation bullet.
Right.
Those are kind of all tied together in a lot of ways, because some people are proposing, well, UDRP doesn't work anymore, or it doesn't work in certain cases. Let's have an alternate to the UDRP to deal with those.
Hey, Greg, this is Faisal. I'm not sure that – I don't think – maybe I'm missing something, but I don't think there has been any chatter about UDRP being substituted by the rights protection mechanisms. I think it's more – comes alongside it, right? It's the UDRP plus the rights protection mechanisms to enhance, the effectiveness of the UDRP, but not a substitution. I mean,
there have been, I guess, a number of different variations proposed. The IRT basically said, look, UDRP is too slow in cases of blatant cyber squatting. Let's have something instead of it for those cases, right? Is that basically what the IRT said?
Right. So I think the IRT was saying that there. Right. So what the IRT was, I guess, you take the URS, for example, they're looking at it like, there are certain situations where we need a rapid takedown, right? So let's put the mechanism to do that, because the UDRP doesn't do that right now. But that doesn't mean that the UDRP is being substituted out. All I'm saying is I think it's just trying to enhance the effectiveness of UDRP, and maybe if they were to go back and take a look at the UDRP, that potentially you could come up with certain mechanisms within the UDRP itself that could, who knows, make it more effective, maybe even vitiate the URF. Does that make sense?
Well, I don't know. You said there are people who need rapid suspension. But that's a need that, until now, people have. When people had a property dispute about a name, they used UDRP. URS is basically a parallel or separate process, at least for certain kinds of names. So there are a lot of perception questions, and there are a lot of different plans out there, I guess.
Yeah, I guess we won't know. We won't know really how it works, right, until it actually kind of. It happens.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, anyway, my question is: should we work on the wording of the recommendations? It sounds like folks want to recommend that there be an issues report on the kind of the current state of the UDRP. Is that what you want?
Well, I guess this is Faisal again. I guess the question is, do we want the issues report, or do we want to bypass the issue report straight into the PDP? Right? Is that the question?
Well, yeah. I don't know.
And this is James. I believe that by saying PDP, I presume that the issues report was the launch pad, if you will, for getting that PDP going. So if you'd rather say issues report, Greg, I'm fine with that.
It sounds like Marika said you have to have an issues report before you start a PDP.
And this is Marika, and that's correct. Of course, if there's a lot of information available, it means that an issues report can be very quickly delivered. And currently there are very short timelines for that anyway. But the formal step in the current process, and just a caveat that we are looking at reviewing the whole process in another working group, is that indeed the issues report is the first required step in launching a PDP.
Okay. So I guess the answer then would be yes, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think in this, for the purposes of this recommendation, saying that we want to initiate a PDP or we want to initiate an issues report, I understand there's a distinction in the terminology, but I think that the intention is the same.
It's up to the council. Let's see. Well, either way, it's up to the council. They'll decide whether or not they want either one of them, right? So.
Well, this is Mikey. I think that one of the nice things about recommending an issues report is that it gives the council a little more freedom to choose the course. If we recommend a PDP, then they have to vote up both an issues report and the subsequent PDP process, whereas an issues report could just end at that point and gather. One of the points that James made earlier in the conversation is that one very helpful thing that an issues report would do is just become the clearinghouse for all of the issues that surround the UDRP. And perhaps simply having that clearinghouse is enough to get to the next stage of the conversation without having to launch a formal PDP. So I think I'd support the idea of our report recommending an issues report rather than a PDP.
And this is Marika. If I can just correct one of the statements there, because an issues report automatically triggers a vote on the initiation of a PDP. And, of course, a vote might say no, or there might be some recommendations in the issues report that say, well, maybe it's not timely, maybe you should do first some other works, like work what, for example, happened with the registration of use policies issues report. But in principle, an issues report always triggers the vote whether to initiate a PDP or not.
So maybe it's essentially... No difference.
Yeah, Mike. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think at this point, what we're saying is that the capture of the intention of this recommendation is, then we could certainly reword it to say initiating an issues report. And I don't mean to presume and speak for Faisal on this one, but it just seems like that's what we were getting at. And if there's a cleaner way to say that so that we don't presume any or skip any steps, then that's fine.
This is Mikey again. I think that the nub of this is that we are pointing at the UDRP and saying there are puzzles in there that need some hard work to solve, and we think it's a good idea to start that work.
Right.
Right. Basically, as somebody said, we need a summary of all the issues, which, because there are a lot of questions that have come up about the UDRP.
Now, this is Mike again. I think that maybe what James was getting at is that they uncovered a lot of questions, but that there are even more questions out there that need to get discovered, and that that would be a big piece of what was discovered in the report.
Yeah, Mikey, that's a good point. This is James speaking. I think that we found that there were so many issues that touched on or were central to some sort of a review of the UDRP when we discussed this topic, that, you know, kind of made us nervous. What were we not seeing? What types of constituencies or stakeholders were out there that had perhaps other issues that weren't on the sub-team or on the RAP group or maybe aren't vocal within the community as well. But, you know, by getting this some greater exposure, maybe, you know, maybe we could kind of shake the trees a little bit and get some more of those, get a more comprehensive picture of what's going on with UDRP.
So this is Mikey again. You know, one way to approach this is to use my oft-repeated cop-out example and make a list of the issues that you all uncovered a part of the recommendation, but put a caveat in front of it that says this is by no means comprehensive. But
or that can go in the background section. It's a good thing to go in a background section saying, you know, we understand there are a bunch of issues, including the following, which, you know, may need some a lot of further discussion.
Yeah, same sort of thing. And so what I'm hearing from Greg is, for a person reading this report, it's useful to have a list right there just to get their mind thinking about it, rather than leaving the list out. And back to Faisal and James, would that cause you guys great heartburn to add such a list?
Well, Mikey, this is James, and I don't want to sound like a negative person here, but you know, please recall that this is the third reconstitution of the cyber squatting subgroup. So going back and picking up that trail of breadcrumbs, there's value to it, absolutely. I just don't know how quickly or practically that can be accomplished. So just wanted to put that out there. Certainly, you know, Faisal and Martin and I can probably put together the things that happened or were discussed most recently in this most recent iteration. But, you know, the further back we go, the more likely we are to miss something.
This is Mikey. You know, I don't think that this needs to be anything more than the two of you or the three of you just exchanging an email that, you know, quickly reconstitute the list of issues as an example, and then you're done. I understand how hard it is to go back through three layers of a subgroup when
This is Greg. One of the ideas here is if we're going to recommend that the council do a certain thing, in the background we need to say why that is. You know, give enough substance to kind of substantiate the recommendation. And it might not be very difficult. We could probably pretty quickly name several things about the UDRP that have come up in the community. You know, people have said in certain cases it's too costly or it's too slow. There are questions have come up. You know, one of the issues of bad faith is use, but we also have decisions where there's been no use. So, you know, what does that mean? We could probably just come up with a few things to say. Here's some examples of why the whole thing needs to be revisited, and we need a hard look at it, just to give the council something to go on.
And
substantiate the recommendation.
You know, maybe what we do is we just let the editing of the final draft of our report flush out a list. If you and Faisal could just get it started, but, you know, not try and come to any agreement, just write a few bullets, capture the ones that Greg just did, and then as we get to final editing on the report, we can add a few more and hash that out and call her done.
This is Faisal. I think we could do that. James,
okay.
I don't know if you...
Yeah,
okay.
I agree.
So that's our action item between now and the next meeting, which is to tweak that language on the wiki.
I got some time on Thanksgiving Day. Do you, James?
Don't
Yeah, surprisingly, I looked at my calendar, and I don't think anybody scheduled any meetings for that day, so that might...
Well, unfortunately, we've got a lot of Americans on this call.
Yeah.
We're gonna have to get George Kirikos back again.
He was Canadian. They've already had their Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
That Detroit
and,
is pretty
I can't
you might want to play you might want to do some work during that time.
Before we go on, okay, well anyway, that's an action item. We'll work on the language. I think maybe the background section has always been designated as a place to provide that background and substantiate what follows, which would be a recommendation or recommendations.
Right.
So let's work on that then. And we can move on. Any last thoughts on the cyber squatting? We've got an action item. Okay. If not,
Greg,
oh, go ahead, Barry.
The only thing I would say there is that there were a few other recommendations on the wiki itself, such as sending names to search engines and whatnot. How do you want those integrated? Or do you want those as issues, or I guess I'm kind of throwing it out there.
You know, Faisal, I was looking at that too. That's a good question. One thought I had was, you know, when we're talking about building out this list of this non-comprehensive, non-exhaustive list of things that should be looked at and discussed, I think it's, possibly. But those, you know, if they don't have any tie into the UDRP, then I guess that they would have to go somewhere else.
Yep. Okay.
Go ahead.
You're referring to the bit that said work with search engines and strict pay-per-click and stuff?
Yeah, I think that's what Faisal was mentioning as well. You know, if it doesn't fit cleanly into one of the existing recommendations, then maybe it warrants a fourth.
It may also be outside of kind of ICANN's scope, which is messing with what search engines display to people. I think that's outside scope of ICANN totally.
Well, it's outside scope for policy, but it's certainly other recommendations like just, you know, becoming more familiar and coordinating and communicating a little bit better, you know.
Good. Okay, so anything else on cyber squatting?
Yes, Barry, just a quick question. With the discussion for the difference between an issues report versus a PDP, should I restructure the uniformity recommendations in that regard as well? Should we still be requesting a PDP or an issues report? And if so, I'll change it.
And this is Marika. I'm happy as well to streamline that in, you know, the final document so, you know, all the recommendations talk about the same thing, whether that's, you know, requesting an issues report or initiating a PDP. So we have standard language, so we can deal with it that way as well.
All right,
as a group of first.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Marika. Okay. So anyway, we have about 20 minutes left. We need to see if we can start knocking off some of these last topics that were raised so we can, you know, either flesh them out or just dispose of them. One of the abuse topics was pay per click. And I don't recall offhand who proposed that many, many months ago. Does anybody recall?
This is Mikey. I think that one came in our charter.
Did it?
Yeah. Well, wasn't there some getting the name of the document that it was on our doorstep when we first began the working group? And as I recall, a bunch of us sort of scratched our heads and said, I don't know how that got there, but
yeah, it wasn't in the charter, but somebody had brought it up during the early brainstorming sessions, and it ended up on our list of abuse categories. Let me read you what we have on it. Is the use of a trademark in a domain name to draw traffic to a site containing paid placement advertising. So that strikes me as an intellectual property or cyber squatting.
The way I hear that, this is Mikey, the way I hear that sentence is that the big problem that they're dealing with is the trademark in the domain name, not the...
Yeah. So is that a cyber squatting issue?
Yeah,
Greg. This is James. I'm sorry, Mikey. Yeah, I noticed that as well. And I apologize to Faisal because I was just under the gun to get something before the call. But over the weekend, I packed in onto our first background as just kind of description of how pay-per-click is used to profit from the brand infringement activities of cyber squatting. So, you know, kind of unilaterally lump that in with the cyber squatting abuse, which probably should have done that on a more consultative basis.
Well, that's okay. Yeah, and it probably should be said, just for the record, that some pay-per-click is not associated with cyber squatting or brand infringement at all.
Yeah,
it's more of a mechanism for gathering traffic and sending it on and getting revenue out of a pay-per-click model. But it sounds like the issue that was of concern is people using other people's brands or trademarks to attract traffic. And that, to me, seems like a cyber-squatting issue. Does everybody agree with that?
Mikey, I certainly agree with that.
Okay.
Rod, I agree, certainly. And if we're going to classify pay-per-click as an abuse category, then Google may have a major problem with us.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who might.
Okay. I tell you what, it sounds like it's a cyber-squatting issue. I can I'll volunteer to write up a paragraph about what we actually meant by that, but it sounds like it's a cyber-squatting, it's just a subspecies of the cyber-squatting problem.
Yeah, I think that's
right. I would propose that we kind of just move on and...
Yeah.
Okay. All right. 419 and other kinds of scams. Okay. The 419 scam is your classic grift. the example being those Nigerian officials who need you to help them facilitate a money transfer. We all get those via mail, email. So those are various kinds of scams. They're usually advertised via email. But what is the real question? Is it a spam problem, or is it a malicious use of a domain name for a landing page? What's the real issue here?
This is Mikey. There's an interesting article today in the news that Google has just changed its policy from taking down specific pay-per-click ads for scam sites and moving over to taking down the advertiser. That's kind of, in a way, relevant to this. I think the issue in this one is to what extent the domain name is involved. In a way, this is similar to the conversation we just had about brand abuse. But Rod, you're the one that I would turn to on this one. Would it be useful to have ICANN involved in these kinds of issues or not? And if so, how?
Well, the 419 advanced fee fraud stuff is getting trickier and trickier to deal with. There's two primary abuse elements that can touch on the domain name space and the ICANN world. One is, Greg mentioned the email side. I can create, use a look-alike type email or some sort of convincing email domain, let's say banksecurity.info, to pick on info for a second, as my, or a branded one like Barclays PLC update. I think I saw one just like that the other day, as my email address domain. Then the other part of it is typically, and this is where it's getting more and more sophisticated these days, are the basically the fake business websites where I set up a website to give myself legitimacy and I can refer people who I'm emailing or calling or what have you to my website and say, well, take a look here. Here's this can go for mule recruiting as well, which I'm not sure. I think that might be one of the other categories. It was very similar in it. I've got this fake business that I've set up on the web, and I am supporting my basically my con of the victims by providing this website and has all this beautiful information about my wonderful company, how big it is, and has fancy graphics and flash and all kinds of cool stuff. There's some of the sites are far better than a lot of the Fortune 500 commercial sites. As far as just kind of the impression you get when you first go there. So, but I'm registering a domain name in order to support that kind of activity. So there's, it touches in this space, and it's very difficult to get some of these down because they look legitimate. And it's, you've got to go through a long investigatory process to prove that they're not who they say they are. And then what do you do? Now, I would argue that that is largely a use issue rather than a registration issue. Because you don't know where they are typically until some of these scams go out. So that's one part of this. I think there's a lack of policy around this area because it does change so much. But the question is, would this group touch it? Then the other part of this, I would say, that could touch what we've been talking about is analogous to what we've been talking about with the phishing side, which is some of these guys use the same exact setups all the time for their scams. So if I'm, got my fake company set up, I will come and use the same exact internet infrastructure to register new domains. So I could, at that point, and I'm sure some of the registrars out there are doing this, or is looking for these kinds of criminal setups that they already know about, and saying, okay, well, you're coming in here trying to set up yet another fake business site. I'm not going to let you do that. So that's where you could actually address this at the registration level. But for the most part, I think this is a use issue.
And this is Greg. In some ways, this kind of activity bears some resemblance for me with phishing. Basically, both phishing and 419 scams or advanced fee scams are attempts to defraud people or steal their money. Both are advertised via spam. And then you have to determine the legitimacy or illegitimacy of the entity somehow. And I agree with Rod that it's kind of not so much a registration issue as you find out about these things afterwards, after they've gone up. Sometimes the domain names they use are fairly random or indistinguishable from any other kind of registration. I've seen more than a few myself. So, James, I see your hand raised.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. And just quickly, I do agree with Rod and yourself when you're saying that this is much more a use issue than a registration issue. And in general, this category of abuses is the one that makes me feel the most uneasy in discussing it in the venue of an ICANN policy context, because I think that for those of us old enough to remember that before they were doing this particular type of a confidence game via email, it was being done over fax, and prior to that, it was coming in mimeographed or Xerox pages that were either sent by postal mail or tacked up in bulletin boards. So I really think we're starting to get outside of an area that, you know, if we had a policy, it would just fix this problem. I think we're starting to touch on issues that are bigger than the domain name registration system, and that just makes me a little uncomfortable about including it in our category or in our catalog of issues.
Mikey? Thank you, James.
This is Mikey. I guess the thing that intrigues me about, I agree, James, with everything you said. The thing that intrigues me about the registration side of this is, suppose that there's a bad actor. We'll go back to Rod's, a gang that has this totally cool website that looks like a business. And suppose that there were a way to identify repeat offenders, people who over and over and over and over again just registered domain names like crazy to perpetrate these scams. Would it be useful to registries and registrars, and this is not a rhetorical question, this is a question for you guys that are, would it be useful to have a mechanism to, once they've been identified by magic, I'm not going to get into that at all, but presuming that they could be identified, would it be useful from a policy standpoint to provide the same sort of air cover and indemnification, et cetera, that we've been talking about in other cases, for you all to prevent repeat offenders from registering any more domains? And would the, and then the question to Rod is, if that all transpired, would that actually be effective in doing anything?
This is Greg. I think what you're suggesting is, do you treat these within that umbrella of malicious uses of domain names? In other words, do you use similar techniques or policies that you use to deal with you know, malware or phishing or what have you? Is that kind of where you're going?
It's partly that, and then it's taking it one step further and essentially asking the question. Up till now, we've just talked about a single domain name and a single actor, and each time you'd have to go through that process. The thing that came up this morning in this article about Google's change in policy is they're stepping through the instance to an actor that's a repeat offender. And they're identifying those actors, and they're nipping them off rather than trying to take down the individual. In this case, it's pay-per-click ads. But
yeah. What you're pointing to, Mikey, is a situation that comes up in my work, for example, where you've got somebody doing something which is undesirable. And it could be it could be malware or whatever, but a malicious activity. And the question is, what do you do when they keep doing it? Do you deal with it on a domain-by-domain basis, or do you suspend their whole portfolio of domain names if it looks like they're just going to keep doing it with new domains? Or, you know, what do you do to keep them away? And these are questions, these are really interesting kind of policy and operational questions that come up when dealing with really bad people, basically. So I think this is a subspecies of a larger issue, which is, what do you do with malicious uses of domain names and the people who are perpetrating them? How do you deal with them?
Yeah, I think that's right. And from my perspective, I don't have, at least at this stage, real strong opinions one way or the other, but I think that it would be a useful... I agree that 419 scams as an abuse category, I agree with your assessment, Greg, that this is a subset of malicious abuse and could get rolled up into that. And that we could write the paragraph on the table that way. And I don't necessarily think that my notion of what to do about repeat offenders goes in that paragraph. That's a broader thing. we might want to step back and add to our list of topics.
Okay.
Let me add a point or two here. These cases are really hard to deal with at the registrar level, not from a registrar like GoDaddy, but more from a registrar that's somewhere else in the world. Now, of course, it's mainly a use issue, but there's really a lack of any sort of policy written around these types of abuses. Make it very difficult to get some players in the market to take any sorts of action. So just creating some sort of language that incorporates these different, I won't call them oddball abuses, but non-obvious abuses that can be very harmful would be helpful in at least providing some direction. I think the other part, and Mikey was dead on, I think, with his analysis there, is that we've got this kind of series of abuses, and we've been talking about it in the phishing context and the malware context, but there's a series of abuses that really comes down to, from a registration perspective, the only thing you can really talk about are going after the repeat offenders and the people with particular criminal infrastructure that's identifiable. We've had that discussion quite a bit, but I think it applies to almost all of these. And Mikey asked a question a few minutes ago, will that make a difference if we actually can do something about it? Yes and no would be the answer, I think. We've already seen a lot of, the latest report that Greg and I put out about use of TLDs. There were more malicious subdomain registrations than there were domain registrations. That's an area out completely, I would say, almost completely outside of ICANN's remit in the subdomain reselling space. But I also think it's important that we create the precedent and infrastructure, policy, et cetera, around dealing with this kind of thing so that wherever these bad guys go to, we have a good solid example, assuming we could kick them out of domain names, which would be a nice thing to do. But we have a good example to point to when we're dealing with other types of organizations and other types of industries that will be affected by the pushing of bad guys out of one field. And I also think that, the current domain registration field, it's about the easiest way to get an internet presence set up. Some of these other ones, you have to go through maybe a couple other hoops. So raising the bar on bad guys is always good.
Okay. You know what? We've come to the end of the hour and a half. We got through a couple of issues there, but I'm thinking we need to roll up 419 within a broader category of malicious uses of domains because they share a lot of characteristics and problems at the policy level.
Greg, this is James.
Oh, I'm sorry, James. Go ahead.
Yeah, just very quickly, I was just curious if Greg or Rod, if you could just clarify what you meant when you said it would be difficult for registrars except for GoDaddy.
Oh, it's just because you're big, that's all.
Well, no.
I was going to amplify that, too.
That's quite
well, we like our resources and our folks to be working on things as well, not tied up with
the internet. and I don't think that's quite what I said.
That's why I was asking, if you could clarify.
When dealing with, we identify as a first responder or what have you, we identify this abuse. Registrar like GoDaddy, once we've reported the abuse, it's not usually not a problem to get things taken care of. It's other registrars out there that don't have the experience, resources, whatever you want to call it, goodwill towards their fellow men. That's those are the ones that are difficult to deal with. I was actually praising GoDaddy for being good at dealing with these kinds of issues quickly and efficiently.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to make sure that when we were being singled out like that, I just wanted to make sure that it was as a positive example.
Absolutely positive.
That's the way I took it.
Well,
okay,
this is Mikey. I'd like to add one dimension to that, and that is that another reason why I thought that Rod mentioned GoDaddy is because GoDaddy sees a lot of, pretty significant proportion of the total domains registered in any given TLD. And one of the other difficulties that a smaller registrar is going to have is it's going to be much harder for them to identify a repeat offender because they're not going to see the breadth of the TLD that a big registrar like Network Solutions or GoDaddy will. And that means that the issue in many cases either has to be dealt with at the registry where they can see the whole space, or there has to be some mechanism for registrars to communicate between themselves about bad actors.
So it's more of a question of perspective at that point.
Yeah.
In our next meeting, I'll tell you an interesting story about that.
So
remind me about that, Mikey. Have a good story for you. Okay. So anyway, we've come to the end of our meeting, unfortunately, but we got a lot done today. I'm very encouraged. Next time we'll pick up with traffic diversion and so forth. The next question, though, is when should we have our next meeting? A few of you have responded to the doodle. Myself, Barry, Rod, and Mikey have, at least. If you haven't responded to the doodle, please do so, and I'll send a reminder out to the mailing list. But it looked like so far the best option for next week would be Monday at the same time. In the afternoon wasn't quite so good. I know I couldn't make it at 2:30 Eastern. And then Wednesday wasn't quite so good either. So I'm gonna propose that we have to the list that we do have the meeting next Monday at the same time. And unless there's significant problems with that, I think you should probably count on it. And then we're going to try to, during the next meeting, we'll try to lock in the rest of the meeting times using those doodle results for now through January. So this is a good meeting. Thanks, guys. We'll continue to work offline on the wikis, on the contracts and cyber squatting. But I think we got into some really meaty stuff today. Very much appreciated. Great discussion. So any closing thoughts? Okay. For those in the U.S., have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Same to you, Greg.
Thank you. Thank you. And enjoy, and we'll talk again very soon.
Okay. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.